So the title of today's session is Energy for the Future, Exploring Methane Gas to Energy Projects at Superfund Sites. EPA's Superfund Redevelopment Initiative has been hosting webinars on CLUIN since April of 2009 as part of our effort to celebrate over 10 years of innovative efforts on the part of communities and other stakeholders to return Superfund sites to beneficial uses. Our last webinar celebrated our partnership with the Academy of Model Aeronautics and our success in working together to create new flying fields for model airplane enthusiasts. This month's webinar is going to cover a topic that is gaining a lot of momentum and generating a lot of interest across the country. Using the methane generated in landfills and putting it to good use rather than allowing it to contribute to greenhouse gas emissions. The speakers we have today are Steve Chang from the EPA Superfund program. We have Jack Dowden and Mike Peterson from Waste Management Incorporated, Terry Garon and Kurt Publow from Southside Landfill. And I want to thank everyone for joining us today because I'm looking forward to your presentation. And I also encourage everyone to be on the lookout for future SRI seminars. From the Superfund program, he's going to share some of EPA's considerations when assessing methane use potential at Superfund sites. Steve is an environmental engineer with the U.S. EPA Superfund program located in Washington, D.C. As the Superfund liaison with EPA Office of Research and Development, he also likes to work on implementing innovative ideas for Superfund hazardous waste site cleanup. His current interests include greenhouse gas reduction from Superfund landfills and recovery of methane energy and groundwater vapor intrusion related issues. Steve has a BS in chemical engineering from the University of California at Berkeley, an MS in agricultural engineering from the University of Maryland, and an MS in computer science from Johns Hopkins. So with that, I'd like to welcome Steve to give his presentation to you all.
Good afternoon, everyone. I hope I can speak loud enough so you can hear me. The Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, or OSREDI, launched this landfill methane to energy pilot program back in October of 2009. The goal is stated as evaluate and increase the number of landfills on the Superfund national priorities list that use the methane generated on site. But we also have an aim to reduce greenhouse gas emission from the landfills that we work with. Just to give some credits to our partnership, we launched this program in partnership with EPA Regions 1, 2, and 3, the Landfill Methane Outreach Program, or LMOP, under our Air and Radiation Office, and our Federal Facilities Remediation and Restoration Office. We gratefully acknowledge their support in funding and also in staff time. We realize right off the beginning that when we...
Can you announce what slide number you're on?
I'm moving on from slide number 2 to number 3. We realized from the beginning...
Okay. Your slide numbers are different.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Okay. We're now on slide 5, technical considerations for using landfill gas.
At the beginning, we realized that people would ask a question about potential liability issues related to Superfund landfills or hazardous wastes. So this is one thing that we are sensitive about. We looked into the quality of the landfill gas to find if there is any known compounds in the gas or landfill that would preclude or greatly impact the cost of using landfill gas, such as radioactive waste and so on. And we also look into the quantity of landfill gas, like how much gas is present, what is the methane concentration. We pick a range, and I'll try to explain why. We made the decision not to compete with private industries to develop a commercially available project. So we're looking in the range of 100 to 400 standard cubic feet per minute. landfill gas candidates, and let me explain why. From what my contact with the industry folks, we were told that the industry usually likes to develop a project, commercial project, if there's at least 1 megawatt of electricity per year generation. So that's roughly translated to about 400 standard cubic feet per minute, SCFM. And in the other extreme, we were told, advised by our LMOP partner, that 100 is a good cutoff point below which there may not be any useful gas that we can use. But I would want to say that we might want to change that, because at the LMOP conference in January in Baltimore, I heard a presentation by a gentleman who is from a rural county in North Carolina. He stated that at his site he could generate 40 SCFM, but he could use that gas to sustain an artist colony, like bringing glass blowers, blacksmith, and whatnot, and that would attract, and they do succeed in, they did it in success, and that they can attract tourists. So the 100 is not a set concrete lower limit, but currently that's what we use, between 100 to 400 SCFM, landfill gas. I'll move on to the next slide.
Slide number 6.
We also look into the accessibility of landfill gas, like how expensive would it be to collect the gas. A gas collection system, we realize, is very expensive. So it helps the bottom line to have a collection system in place. So that is one of the criteria we use when we try to select candidate landfills. Complicating site factors, such as flooded wells, very shallow ways, those would reduce the landfill gas collected by a well, and therefore there's a need for additional wells, and that, of course, will affect the bottom line. We also look at the energy demand. For example, what is the energy need for landfill-related activities, such as a groundwater pump and treat system, or heating a greenhouse on site, or building on site? What remedial equipment such as pumps and blowers? And the landfill, is it located in an area with nearby off-site energy demands? I would hold off on that because I believe the next two presenters will talk more about this issue. But the bottom line is that if a landfill can generate between 100 to 400 SCFM landfill gas but has no use on site, that may not be an incentive to develop this landfill project. Now, on the other hand, if we can perhaps supplement the energy on site need, then there may be incentive for the municipalities and responsible parties to come forth and help develop this project. I'm going to move on to the next slide.
Slide 7. I just want to jump in real quick. If anyone is having problems with their audio streaming, please use the question mark icon to make us aware of that. Name and phone number so we can have someone get in contact with you to help you resolve your issue. Sorry, Steve.
So armed with these initial considerations, we set out to locate potential landfills. We initially partnered with Region 1, 2, and 3 in the Northeast, and that's the reason, because they expressed an interest in looking at some of the older landfills. But unfortunately, we found that many of these old landfills, they were closed for more than 20 years, that they're producing very little recoverable methane. However, I caution that the jury is still out for the rest of the country to find suitable landfills because of the following reasons. Number one, I was not able to do a systematic search My primary contacts are with the regional counterparts, the remedial project managers, word of mouth, contact with industry folks, because our current system in EPA database does not track utility requirement on site, does not track how many wells are producing methane, the methane composition, and all that. In order to do this, to get these data, we have to contact the individual project managers or municipalities. So it has taken quite a bit of effort on my part to try to contact, find people, and talk to people. And that's why we have not been able to do a lot of searches, but we have at least looked at over 50 sites in the process. So in that way, I would say we look at only region 1, 2, and 3 in a more systematic way, but the rest of the country, the jury is still out. For 1, 2, and 3 region, we found that there are few landfill NPL landfills that are producing marketable quantities of methane. That means it's greater than 1 megawatts of electricity per year. But these landfills might produce enough to offset on-site electricity usage. In other words, they could be supplement to the on-site energy need. The cost of recovery for small methane flows, unfortunately, is expensive. And this is why we selected landfills primarily with existing collection system. We estimate that the energy demands at NPL landfills are generally in the size range of microturbines, in a range of like 0.1 megawatts per year of electricity. So, and you, by comparison, most utilities require at least 1 or 2 megawatts as a minimum for purchasing electricity. So our older landfills do not produce enough electricity to sell, but then they can supplement the on-site energy needs. I'm going to move on to the next slide.
Slide 8.
Our contractor, Eastern Research Group, Shaw and Cornerstone, they're developing the draft screening criteria that will be used in conjunction with the EPA LandJam and landfill gas cost models to determine the practicality of using landfill methane to produce energy for on-site use. Just a note, the LandJam calculates the potential gas flow from landfill, and landfill gas cost calculates the economics of a project. So these criteria will include factors that are likely to have a significant impact, either positively or negatively. We are, again, mentioned that we are looking primarily, or at least initially, looking for cost-effective on-site use to supplement the energy need. So we are not shutting the door, but this is our primarily looking criteria. Next slide.
Slide 9.
That's the tentative schedule. I've just talked to my contractor, and they will submit the first 6 analyses by next Friday for me to look at, so I can have something to say. I know a little bit to talk about that. I will hold off for now. Next slide, please.
We're on slide 10.
The key word is to encourage, as the next step, encourage our regional counterparts to find suitable NPL landfill methane to energy projects, applying the screening criteria once we develop this. Again, the key word is cost effective, supplement on-site energy need, somewhere between 100 and 400 SCFM, but not focus on commercial development, even though we surreptitiously came across one that is commercially viable. That was not our main goal, however. We also want to encourage EPA regions to collaborate with interested municipal authorities and responsible parties to implement the projects. Just so you know, the landfill data currently is not available in our EPA database. Again, we don't have the landfill gas flow rate, the methane composition, and utility usage. That's, we have to go to our site managers to get that data if they are willing to work with us. With that, I'll stop, and if I can entertain some questions, feel free.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Does anyone have any questions? At this point, those on the phone, you can feel free to speak up and ask your questions. If you had put us on mute using the pound six code, you can hit star six to unmute at this time. Okay, well, if you think of any questions as the next presenter is speaking, feel free to, as I said, use the question mark icon. Now, and I'll read it aloud. It says, regarding landfills without gas collection systems, What will it take to make gas collection cost-effective?
There are a whole host of reasons why we didn't look at it, because besides the cost, I heard from my contractor that it costs about $20,000 to install a gas well. So if you have a landfill that is potentially viable, you have to think about, are you going to be able to sell your gas as carbon credit, or you can get a grant from the Federal Department of Energy or Commerce Department, and will you be able to use it for regional greenhouse carbon trade? All those factors come into to the analysis. I hope I answered the question.
Okay. Has anyone thought of any other questions before we move on to the next presenter? Okay, thanks, Steve. So our from Waste Management Incorporated, we're now on slide number 11, and the title says Role of Landfill Gas to Energy and Landfill Remediation. And Jack also has Mike Peterson with him to help with any questions that might come up that he might need to defer to him too. So so Jack has served as the Area Director in Waste Management Incorporated's Closed Site Management Program since 1998. In this capacity, Jack has overall responsibility for 36 closed landfills that span Wisconsin, Illinois, Missouri, Kansas, and the Dakotas. In addition, Jack represents Waste Management's interest as a potentially responsible party, or PRP, on 7 active Superfund sites. Within this portfolio, Waste Management operates 7 landfill gas to energy electric projects and 2 alternative energy projects. 2 of the electric projects are among the oldest and longest continuing operating landfill gas to energy plants in the United States. Prior to his position with Waste Management, Jack worked for 17 years in the environmental consulting and solid waste management industry, specializing in groundwater investigations, site remediation, and large project siting and permitting. In the course of Jack's professional career, he's been involved as lead investigator, project manager, or PRP representative on over 50 Superfund or RCRA corrective action projects. Jack earned a BS degree in earth science from the University of Wisconsin at River Falls, and an MS in hydrogeology from the University of Nevada in Reno. He's previously served as a school board president and director for a lake conservation district in his home state of Wisconsin. And with that, let's welcome Jack to share his presentation with us.
Thank you, Michelle, and good afternoon, everyone. The purpose of my presentation is to discuss various types of landfill gas to projects that are in operation, and in direct response to Steve's question or focus, provide some insights into the factors and criteria that determine the success of a landfill gas to project. Now, or gas to energy project.
I'm on mute.
Steve has identified that the agency is looking at smaller scale projects, what might be called micro projects. But I think a lot of the experience that we've gained from the larger scale projects is scalable and it can provide some perspective. So I'm going to try to cover some basic fundamentals of landfill gas to energy and then discuss the small scale project that we were involved with at a Superfund site in northern Illinois. And then I want to close by offering some insights and opinions about the potential for landfill gas to energy at remedial sites. Just a little plug for waste management. We are one of the, if not the largest, single developer and operator of landfill gas to projects in the world, with over 120 active projects ongoing. And right now there are dozens, literally dozens, of projects in various stages of planning, design, and construction. I've been in this business for 23 years now, and this is truly the most exciting time in the field of landfill gas energy that I've ever seen. With that, if we could move on to slide 12, I'm just going to cover some basics. Methane or landfill gas is a product of anaerobic decomposition of organic waste. It's about half methane, half carbon dioxide. In terms of a heating value, it is about half of natural gas. We're looking somewhere between 450 to 550 BTU per standard cubic foot. Natural gas is 1,030. Putting this into perspective with regard to other gases or fuels, propane is about 2,500 BTU per cubic feet, butane's 3,200, and something that's becoming more and more relevant is coal-based syngas, which is 125 to 350 BTU. Try to keep those figures in mind as we talk about alternative projects further on here. But basically, landfill methane is a medium to low to medium grade fuel source. We can move to the next slide. Talk briefly about gas collection and control. Gas collection and control systems, GCCS as we call them, are installed primarily for environmental protection, to control underground migration of gas, also to limit groundwater contamination. Many of the volatile organic compounds that we find in groundwater are more soluble in a gas than they are in liquid or leachate. So they tend to migrate with the gas. As that gas cools off, those VOCs condense and come out into the shallow groundwater. So control of landfill gas is important, particularly at sites with VOC contamination or landfills with VOC contamination. Obviously, methane has a distinctive odor to it that will never be confused with perfume. We want to limit any nuisance value it has in terms of odor. It also, particularly at sites where you're putting on a composite cover, if you don't maintain control of the methane or the landfill gas, it will build up underneath the plastic or polyethylene cover, and it lifting it from the soil, causing instability. In a couple high-profile instances, we've actually seen slope failures of covers because the landfill gas was not controlled. And more recently, in the last 5 to 10 years, the control of methane gas for purposes of controlling NMOC emissions or greenhouse gas emissions has come into the forefront. Again, methane is 21 times more destructive, has 21 times more destructive capability for ozone destruction than CO2. So it's clearly a focus, not only for landfills, but for, you know, large animal facilities. We rarely ever, I really can't think of a time where a gas control system was installed strictly for supporting a gas-to-energy project. It is always done for environmental controls. in response to one of the previous questions, or the previous question, from a PRP standpoint or a private industry standpoint, the cost for your gas collection system is viewed as a sunken cost. It's already part of the equation. You're not looking to gain any benefit from that per se, or return on investment per se. So we can go to the next slide. And again, I'm going to move through this pretty quickly. For an active landfill, a gas collection system is installed incrementally throughout the life of it. For a remedial system, obviously you're doing it after the fact. But the essential components are all the same. We have vertical wells, or for shallow landfills, maybe horizontal collectors. Those are connected to a header pipe, which has a blower or a vacuum on one end. You use that pipe to apply vacuum to each well. You have to be able to manage the condensate and leachate in these wells. Basically, if you're running a gas collection system, you are managing a biochemical process, and the microbes that are intrinsic to that process are very sensitive to both moisture and acid, oxygen. So you need to be able to control both your vacuum, your oxygen, and your liquid. The landfill gas is delivered to a flare or in our case, many cases, engines or turbines for utilization. We typically look at costs in the range of $9,000 to $20,000 an acre for a gas collection system. A lot of different factors go into that, but that's the typical range. The next slide shows a picture of a typical gas well installation. The large pipe is, in fact, the well that's been drilled through the waste. It is connected by means of a flex hose to a little riser pipe, which is shown there on the right. That riser pipe is welded to a horizontal collector line. And this picture really shows four fundamental components of landfill gas collection system. First and foremost, you have the cover system, which limits the amount of oxygen and nitrogen that can get into the waste. You have to maintain that because, again, it's an anaerobic process that you're managing and that you're trying to coax along. You have the gas well, obviously. You have a lateral collector system. And on that small pipe, you see a little valve there. That's your primary management device. You manage these fields and balance these fields by controlling the amount of vacuum that is applied to each collector. And in the background, actually, there's a fifth component. Many of you would mistake that for being a garbage truck. In the landfill gas energy business, that is a fuel tanker. The next slide shows the installation of the header pipe. Conceptually, this is nothing more. The analogy I use to people in the public is this is like a central vacuum system you would see in a house. Exactly analogous to this, or to a central vac, but instead of sucking up dirt and dust, you're collecting a combustible gas. And that gas has the potential for fuel usage. So now you've got this gas that you're managing, that you've collected, and what can you do with it? We look at three basic categories of projects. One is electric energy projects, where we produce the electricity through conversion devices for wholesale to electric utilities. Steve has talked earlier that, in general, the utilities are looking for at least 1 megawatt. To engage you and to purchase that power and put it on the electric grid. Another category is alternative energy projects, where the gas is conditioned, compressed, maybe purified, and shipped via pipeline to a user as fuel in boilers, power plants, asphalt plants, cement kilns, industrial dryers, perhaps greenhouses. And a derivative of both of those is hot water recovery. A lot of the focus, and I noticed even Steve's presentation, was on electrical production. But really one of the untapped resources in this whole industry is heat recovery and heat utilization. This can be done through heat exchangers on a flare, or maybe even heat recovery units on exhaust stacks or oil coolers or radiators for some of these conversion devices. The third category, and I think you're going to see a lot of activity in this in the years going forward, is process gas or refined product projects, whereby the gas is purified and converted to either to a liquefied natural gas, primarily for use as vehicle fuels. I should also tell you that, you know, we are working, there's a number of people in this industry working on a process to convert methane to a biodiesel fuel product. And I think there's some exciting developments we're going to see in that field in the next 4 or 5 years. Going back to the heat issue, just to give you some perspective on it, whether it's microturbines, reciprocating engines, or full-scale turbines, the thermal efficiency of most of those conversion devices is about 35 to 45%, so that 55 to 65% of the total thermal value that is in the gas is typically lost through exhaust stacks, radiators, or oil coolers. I want you to keep that in mind as we move through this, because we're going to come back and touch on that later in my presentation. The next slide shows the number of active gas utilization projects that waste management has going on in the country. And I have to confess, but a little disclaimer here, no sooner did I submit this slide to the EPA than I heard about some more projects. And so these numbers, please don't take these numbers as being completely accurate. I think the most accurate statement I could make right now is that we have somewhere between 125 and 140 active gas projects throughout the country. The proportion of projects by type gives you some rough idea of where most of the activity lies. Again, electrical gas to energy, or gas to electric energy, has been by far and away the most popular type of project. But I think we're going to see more processed gas or refined product projects coming forward. I can tell you of the projects, I looked at a report just yesterday for our April production, just the month of April. We produced over 147 on our electrical projects, just electrical projects, over 147,000 megawatt hours, which is roughly enough energy to provide electricity to 500,000 homes. We're never going to supplant, you know, coal or nuclear, but it makes a significant contribution over time. The average landfill gas energy project, and these are primarily waste management's metrics, but it gives you some perspective in terms of what Steve said about the private sector and where we're looking at projects. We are typically looking at 1,600 cubic feet per minute of landfill gas.
I mean, the way.
That equates to about 400,000 million BTUs per year. In terms of electricity, the average size is about 400 kilowatts or 4 megawatts of energy, and that produces 32 million kilowatts per year. Now, trying to take this backwards, and if you ask, well, what size landfill do you need to sustain to get these type of parameters or numbers? We're basically looking at 12 to 15 million cubic yards in place, primarily MSW waste. You know, you're not going to get a lot of gas production off C&D or, you know, soil or inert waste. And the waste has to be relatively young. We're looking roughly in the range of 8 to 12 years in terms of waste age. The next slide shows just a typical 3.2 megawatt plant. It's got four reciprocating engines. The gas is burned right in the engine, and each engine turns a generator that's 800 kilowatts. The net output of a plant like this would be on the order of 2.8 to 3.0 megawatts. You do have some electrical usage demand within the plant itself, so the amount that's exported is somewhere in the 2.8 to 3.0 range. So just looking at a plant like this, how much does it cost to give you some concept of the conversion cost? We're typically looking at a plant like this for capital, including land, the site work, buildings, gas conditioning, equipment, the engines and so forth, the interconnects to get on the power grid, and instrumentation and controls, in the range of $4 to $6 million. A couple of years ago, when the price of steel and copper spiked, that range was $5 to $8 million. It's kind of settled back down now. So 4 to 6 is a good number. Now keep in mind, that doesn't include the cost for your gas collection system. As I indicated previously, that's already sunk money. You've already, from our view of the world, you've already spent that money for environmental control purposes. What's that equate to in terms of long-term operating? What kind of cost are you looking at there? The total cost to generate power, again, we're looking at a 4-megawatt facility, is 2.5 to 3.5 cents per kilowatt hour. That includes your depreciation or your amortization cost, your debt service. It's probably a depreciation period has at least got to be as long as you expect to operate that plant. So, you know, typically it's on the order of 10 to 15 years. You have O&M contracts associated with it, taxes, administration, permitting, and this does not include purchasing the landfill gas. That's the assumption here is that you have the gas accessible to you and you're looking for a way to make beneficial use out of it. That brings us to the next slide to talk about energy pricing.
So we're now on slide 23.
Yes. In the mid-80s, it was very difficult to get public utilities, power utilities, to purchase this gas. The Congress rectified that situation by enacting a law called PURPA, which basically compelled the utilities to buy the energy from qualified facilities for avoided cost. So in other words, if you were a public utility and you had a 1,000 megawatt generating station, you had to calculate what one additional megawatt was going to cost you, and you were then obligated to purchase energy from any independent power producer at that avoided cost. Typically, that worked out to be 3 to 4 cents a kilowatt hour. With deregulation of the power industry, that has bigger spreads than that now. Some of it's lower, some of it's higher. But about 10 years ago, when the green movement started, many states passed renewable energy portfolio standards, we call RPSs, and they compel it's basically governmental controls forcing the power industry to purchase more green power. In the state of Wisconsin, the utility that I buy my electricity from at home just built a 1,000 megawatt generating station, coal-fired station. Under Wisconsin state law now, they also have to go out and find, develop, or purchase 100 megawatts of renewable energy, either in the form of biomass, solar, or wind. That has really, really helped our market, and is part of the reason that we see such a uptick in development here. There's also, as Steve mentioned earlier, the renewable energy credits that are available. Again, you got the Chicago Climate Exchange. You have other people, European markets, that are buying these energy credits. The question I think was posed before talked about, what can you do to cover the cost of gas collection? I don't believe in most instances that the cost for gas collection can be recovered or offset with renewable energy credits. It's because that is you're typically compelled to do that by a regulation or an order, but whether you voluntarily convert that energy to electricity or some other form of power is a voluntary action, and credits can be applied against those costs. Next slide I want to talk about is what are the really keys to a successful landfill gas energy project? And I think some of this scales down. Again, most of this is experience that we've gained from operating the larger scale facilities, but many of these factors scale down to the smaller scale operations that we're talking about potentially with remedial sites. As I indicated before, when I talked 2.5 to 3.5 cents operating costs for those, that didn't include the purchase of landfill gas. In some areas of the country, we're now seeing pricing in the range in excess of a dime per kilowatt hour. That is allowing projects whereby a third party will come in and look at buying the landfill gas, building a plant, and operating it. There's enough margin at those type of prices for these merchant facilities to become viable. And we're seeing more and more of that. But in general, the keys for a successful landfill gas project are access to free, consistent, long-term fuel or gas. And typically it's 12 to 15 years minimum. The user demand needs to match the supply of the gas. And a gas collection system is a 724-365 operation. So the reason the electric projects are so perfectly suited for landfill gas is that if we generate electricity around the clock, the utilities will buy it around the clock. They have a continuous need. Whereas if you're selling it to a factory or something that is working on shifts, they may pay you for a higher unit rate, but they're not buying all of it that you have to offer. The proximity to a user or generator or purchaser is a key factor. There's just not enough margins in this or economies of scale to support a long distance transmission of either the gas or the electricity. So you need to have either the power grid or you need to have a user immediately nearby. And typically we need energy pricing that's competitive with fossil fuels, and we'll get into that a little bit. One thing that we found in our own projects is the ability to limit some aspect of our capital costs, whether it's land acquisition. At some of our older plants, the gas start generation declines. We can pull units out, rebuild them, reuse them at newer projects. Some major aspect of the capital or operating costs you need to be able to limit in order to make these things viable. A lot of the remote sites, which are often characteristic in Superfund portfolios, are kind of geographically stranded with respect to nearby users. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the categories of projects we're looking at is the process gas or the refined products. And I think going forward, that offers a great prospect for some of these remote, geographically remote or stranded projects. Next, I want to go into the next slide, slide 25, describe briefly a project we were involved with about 10 years ago. It's the Antioch Community High School landfill gas energy project, and this won the 2003 LMOP Project of the Year Award. I first want to give credit where credit's due. RMT was Waste Management's contractor for the Superfund RDRA at the HOD landfill. They were both our remedial design consultant as well as our remedial action contractor. They worked with us from 98 to 2001 on the RDRA phase of that project. And in the middle of it, they also stepped forward and started working directly with the high school district to obtain funding for this project, and they subsequently designed it, built it, and they are operating it under contract with the high school. Waste Management provides the landfill, a small plot of land for the compressor station on the landfill, and we give the gas to the high school district for, I think, $1 a year. So basically they have free fuel. The next slide shows the general proximity of the HOD landfill to the high school. You can see that it's the high school and the landfill are separated by an industrial park. The yellow line, that if you follow it, is the route of the gas pipeline. You know, direct line of flight, it's about 950 feet of separation, but the length of that line is about 1,200 feet. So not a lot of transmission costs or capital costs associated with transmitting the fuel from the landfill to the high school. The next slide talks a little bit about this project. First of all, the HOD landfill. It's a 51-acre municipal industrial solid waste landfill. It was active from 63 to 84. However, from 63 to 73, most of the activity there was open burning. So that in terms of the amount of putrescent waste, the amount of organics that were still available to decompose and generate methane, you know, most of that is 1984 or 1974 and younger. The remedial design called for 35 gas extraction wells. That system was installed in 2001 online in 2001. And in the spring of 2001, our initial production rate was about 325 to 350 cubic feet per second. So, again, this is in the range of projects. It's smaller than what we would consider for a commercially viable project, but it's within that range that Steve talked about that EPA is focusing on. The next bullet, and I've highlighted here because we're going to come back to that, the engineer estimated that we'd have over 200 cubic feet per minute for 15 to 20 years. There was a lot of debate, a lot of discussion over that, and I'll come back to it later because it appears that that may have been an overestimate. And the record of decision only called for thermal destruction of the gas. We were not compelled to convert this by the order into any form of electricity. The project with the high school was born out of a question that was submitted by the high school business manager as part of the public comments to the proposed remedial action plan. Prior to the Superfund action, Waste Management had a gas collection at the site. We were flaring gas, and the business manager asked a very simple question, you know, basically, did we have any plans for that gas? I was involved in the school board immediately north of this district. At that time, we knew we had common friends. I reached out to him in 1999, and what ensued was a 3.5-year discussion of what was possible here. And it culminated in the high school project. Now, I need to tell you, at the beginning, in the onset, my vision for this, I didn't think there was a sufficient amount of fuel to justify an electrical project here. We were looking solely at heat recovery and perhaps hot water being piped over to the school to reduce their heating costs, their boiler costs. The next picture slide shows a picture of the gas collection system. In the foreground, you see the large diameter. That is an enclosed flare. It was designed to burn between 660 and 600 SCFM of gas. Right behind that, there's a little flat top structure that includes the blower. That creates a suction that draws all the gas out of the field. 35 wells are connected to that. That is what existed in 2001. And if the building behind that with the pitched roof was constructed later in 2002 by the high school and by RMT, and that houses a compressor that takes the gas, it dewaters the landfill gas, it compresses it, and it ships it over, pumps it over in a pipe to the high school. A few slides back where we had that yellow line on the paper, that's the route of a pipeline that on the upstream side terminates in that building. The next slide discusses the actual project with the high school. And as I indicated, our initial concept was only hot water. It was heating. However, the business manager for this high school was an incredibly resourceful man. He found out that the Illinois Department of Commerce and Community Affairs administered a renewable energy resource program that was specifically, one of its charters was to focus investments in the development and use of renewable energy resources within the state of Illinois. The high school submitted a grant application under the organic waste biomass category in April of 2002, and really to our surprise, the grant of $550,000 was approved. So right off the bat, this project's got two good things going for it: proximity to a source and good timing with respect to the availability of funds. The third key to that was the Capstone microturbine. R&T had, through their previous relations and work on other projects, had identified a number of these microturbines. These happen to be a brand of, called Capstone. They're 30-kilowatt units. And they apparently had been ordered for another project that had not gone forward, and they were able to broker a deal with the high school to get at a greatly reduced cost. So now you've got three things going. The third thing is here. Now you've reduced the capital investment. It was a fast-track project. Design began in September of 2002. Construction began in December. And the system started up in the fall of 2003. Now, I need to interject a little bit of reality here. In the fall of 2001, by the spring of 2001, we were already collecting the gas and we were flaring it. And we were running constantly at 325 to 350 SCFM. However, in the fall of 2001, we started seeing a decline in that. We had discussions with both the high school and the R&T. we wanted them to think through it pretty carefully, whether they wanted to proceed with the electrical component of it, because we weren't sure that we could sustain over 200 SCFM for the time period necessary to recover their capital cost investment. A lot of calculations, a lot of soul searching went on then, but they decided they wanted to go forward with it, and mainly because they had a fallback in that they believed that the capstones could be converted to use with natural gas. Even if the methane died or fell off, they could start, you know, putting natural gas into some of those and generate their own electricity as well as their heat. So, you know, with that fallback kind of in mind, the project went forward. But it was understood that they had to move forward quickly because our gas was production was declining. The system design is pretty simple. It's a compressor on the landfill side, a pipeline. The compressor removes some moisture from the gas and some corrosive compounds, puts it in a pipeline 1,200 feet from the high school. There were 12 microturbines which were installed, capable of totally of 360 kilowatts of three-phase electric at 480 volts. Roughly the equivalent of enough to support 300 homes.
Hey, Jack, you're on sub 32 right now, aren't you?
Page 32, I'm sorry.
Okay.
RMT had to repipe or replumb these microturbines so that the exhaust was run through a heat recovery system, and that was used to preheat water for the gas-fired boilers at Antioch. The next slide, page 33, shows the construction of the pipeline going into the boiler room at the high school. The next page shows the actual installation of the pipe through the walls. And slide 35 basically shows the microturbine. It's a cabinet-sized unit, and the picture here is when they were working on retrofitting it for heat recovery. Again, the benefits of the project were cost savings to the taxpayers, beneficial reuse of the landfill gas, reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. It was a great public relations and marketing for the community and for the state of Illinois. And I think the high school has really done a nice job of leveraging up educational opportunities here. From the economic perspective, it was expected that over the life of the project, this project would save the high school $800,000 in electric and natural gas costs. And a couple years ago, when the energy prices spiked, it looked like they were going to, you know, that would be no problem whatsoever. However, our gas production now has waned. We're down to 125 to 150 SCFM. I guess whether or not we'll ever meet the $800,000 savings is to be determined. But, you know, looking at the project in retrospect, you know, the positive factors are that there was no land acquisition cost involved with this. The grant helped offset a lot of the capital costs. They did get the discount on the microturbines, and they were able to get their fuel at no charge. In looking forward to other projects of this, is that, you know, the hard reality is, at least in our world, from the standpoint of a PRP, is in the end analysis, economic always seems to be the determinant for the success of a project. And you know, the key factor is pricing. You know, what is the value of the methane relative to other energy sources or energy fuel? In particular, is what's the market value of methane? The slide on page 38 shows you know, roughly some ranges in terms of dollars per MMBTU. Methane is competitive with coal on the high end of the range, But the reality is, in many cases, we're still below 80 cents a MMBTU, the low end of coal. Natural gas has twice the heating value, but basically you get four times the market value for it. It's interesting because propane, which has five times the heating value of methane, we think that that's appropriately priced relative to methane because you get roughly four to five times the market value of it. So for going forward, for these projects to be economically successful, we need to be able to get returns on investment or returns on capital where the methane is generally competitive with these fossil fuels. And just in closing here, page 39, the future utilization of methane, and what I'd really encourage EPA to look at is don't get tunnel visioned on electric energy. I think the potential in a few years for generation of vehicle fuel, whether it's liquefied natural gas or biodiesel, is huge. The potential for commercial and industrial heat utilization, pipelines of either hot water or recovered heat, or even small quantities of gas pipelined to nearby factories or large retail. And clearly the area that's underexploited, underdeveloped right now in this whole field is heat recovery. Again, there's 55 to 65% waste heat in many of these combustion devices that just offer a tremendous opportunity for energy. Even in the context of a remediation, for instance, we've looked at shallow tray aeration units, shallow tray air strippers. We know if we can heat the water up just 10 degrees, the VOCs in that will volatilize at twice the rate, and we need less electricity to run the fans across it. So there's other ways to derive the value from landfill energy other than just electrical production. And I think, I'd really encourage the EPA to explore those in their totality. And finally, one thing that's intriguing us, and we're just starting to look at it, is geo-loops and landfills. These landfills are usually 70 to 80 degrees internal core temperature, and there's a lot of heat value in there that can be recovered. So in closing, again, most of the experience, the industry space and experience is on the larger scale facilities like the RDFs. Those are managed under Subtitle D, which came in 1990. So virtually any landfill that would be on the NPL right now, almost all of them would be over 20 years old, which is late in the waste production cycle. What you're looking at is facilities with lower BTU value, lower gas generation, and lower prospects, the production cycle is going to be shorter term rather than longer term. I wish I could give you more specific information on the microturbines and their operating costs and their reliability. We're not in a position to do that, but I do think we do know that there have been some problems with them at the Antioch High School project, but there's certainly long-term potential there. And with that, I'd entertain any questions.
Okay. Thanks, Jack. Are you able to see the questions on the sidebar of the presentation?
Michelle, no, I'm not.
Okay. There's a number of questions that have come in online. And what I'll do is I'll read them to you.
Okay.
I think most of them are directed at you, but Steve is here and he can chime in if need be too. So the first question that we have is, would methane generation enhancement techniques have any application at Superfund landfill sites when combined with energy generation?
Our experience with enhancement of generation is mainly through the injection or mixing of liquids, sometimes biologically active liquids, sludges, pharmaceutical sludges, brewery waste, food and food product waste.
Okay.
So what we have learned is it. We've tried many techniques to do that. We've injected those liquids through wells, through trenches. And I have to be honest with you, there's a plethora of problems that emerge in terms of operating your landfill when you do it. And the problem at remedial sites is generally you're not dealing with good liner systems. And I think as a PRP and the regulators would be highly reluctant to be injecting liquids into a landfill without an engineered containment system. So keep in mind, the number one reason you're collecting landfill gas is for environmental protection, environmental control, and I'm not sure, I would not be comfortable injecting liquids into an unlined facility.
Okay. The next question that we have is regarding the costs of $9,000 to $20,000 per acre for methane gas recovery. Is this for new systems or for retrofits?
It's probably applicable to both. The cost of the pipe is the same. Your well depths may be different. For the larger, newer, reasonable disposal facilities, you're typically thicker waste columns, so your wells are deeper. A lot of the remedial sites won't be that, so your wells may be cheaper. But those costs are scalable or almost equal for retrofits or new construction.
Okay. I'll give you one more question from online, and then I'll go to the phones. It was mentioned that the waste needs to be relatively young, 8 to 12 years. Why is this?
Just in terms of, the minute it's landfilled, it's starting to decompose, and so much of the methane has already been, beyond 12 years, so much of the methane has already been generated and either lost through fugitive emissions or flared off that there's just not enough residual methane generating capacity left to sustain a long-term project.
Okay.
Now again, I want everybody to understand, we're looking at projects. Our average project is 1600 SCFM. Maybe we'll go down to the 800 SCFM level. And as Steve talked about, EPA's looking at projects up to 400. There's going to be some landfills, remedial landfills in the Midwest, where I think you could still find 600, 700, 800 SCFM of gas. I'm not sure about regions 1 through 3, but I'm pretty sure when you get to regions 4 through 7, those are still out there.
Okay. At this point, I'd like to offer anyone who's on the phone line, if you would have a question, to speak up.
Say, Michelle.
Yes?
This is Tom Bloom in Region 5.
Hi, Tom.
I wanted to talk, first of all, Jack, thanks for that presentation. That's incredible.
Tom, how are you doing?
Okay. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the non-tangible benefits that came out of this project, the stuff that you can't really put money on. And there's a couple of them. For example, using this project as an example to other entities, I've had the head of India's environmental department out there. I've had the head of Spain's environmental department out there. They were all impressed with what was going on out there. I've had students from the Arabat Institute, which is an institute in the Middle East that helps Arabic and Israeli students think about environmental problems in the Middle East, out there to look at that place, and they were very impressed. I've had just recently, a couple of weeks ago, I had some newbies from EPA out there that just started working in EPA to go out to that project and see what we have when we put our minds together and partner with everybody in the area. I brought it up to our regional administrator as far as working with communities and showing him concrete projects that we've actually put on the ground, and he was very impressed with the HOD landfill site. In addition to that, we've got an educational curriculum that's going on with the school where they're doing environmental data monitoring with all the kids that are out there, and these kids are getting turned on to doing environmental science and taking careers in the environment. So that's really fantastic of what's going on with working with the communities. We talked about property values around the landfill going up afterwards once we started a project out there. We never talked about the fact, this isn't related to necessarily this talk, but about the recreational fields that we put out there. You know, we've got recreational fields going on out there, and that helped the school. The school was landlocked with their rec fields. They didn't have any place for the kids to play football. They had to ship them off to some other place, and now they're walking across the street basically and practicing football. There's softball fields. There's some more designs for soccer going on. The township put in a 40-acre park in the Barrow area just recently, McMillan Park. We're using, you know, some sustainable like kind of ideas where you're allowing the Antioch School District to take the restroom facilities on these recreational fields and pump them to your leachate tank, and then you're taking care of the restroom, you know, waste through leachate tanks. Disposal instead of having to have a leach field or something like that on site. So I want to tell everybody online that there's a lot of, even though, you know, cost analysis wise this might not have worked out for the best, there's a lot of non-tangible benefits that came out of this project. Oh, and I forgot to mention, Jack, I heard a while ago that, you know, when we had a storm maybe a couple of years ago and the whole city was down for a couple of hours, the only place lit in town was the school.
Yeah, that's true. I guess I should say to everybody, I talked about some of the key success factors of that project. One of the great success factors that went into the project is we had Tom Bloom as our champion with an EPA that helped us expedite that project. And as I said, it was the design and construction of the gas energy was fast tracked. And without Tom being the champion for it, that would never have gone on a fast track. So that was one of the key success factors.
I'll just mention for everyone who doesn't know Tom Bloom, he's the Superfund redevelopment coordinator in Region 5. I'm not sure if you introduced yourself when you started talking, Tom.
Sorry about that.
No, that's okay.
This is S.J. Chen from EPA Region 9. Okay, I have actually a couple questions I'd ask. You know, you are talking about the capstone microturbines, you know. Do you need what kind of percentage concentration of methane in order to generate the power? That's the first question. And the second question is, what is the service life of the capstone, the microturbines? Do you have any idea or the answer for that? Because, you know, I work for OII Industrial Landfill site, and actually it's accidentally, you know, They also published one of my writing in the technology news and trends, you know. It's published last month, April 22nd. So we are also talking about the methane, you know, generate the electricity, you know. So we are looking actually for the replacement of current microturbines because it's been about 7.5 years old. So, you know, I just wanted to know, you know, more information about capstone, you know, how long it lasts, and what kind of concentration of methane we can use for, you know, replacement.
Well, I think in terms of the methane concentration, let me deal with that first. I think those are designed, you know, their optimal window is somewhere 45-47% to 55% methane. If you start getting below that, you start having maintenance problems with those units. In terms of the longevity, they've been online roughly 8 years now. Mike, I'm going to defer to Mike in terms of some of the maintenance issues that have emerged.
The school still has roughly They got 11 turbines still running. They've got motor problems on one of the turbines, and so, you know, they still have 11 running that are putting out power, and we've even run those things down as low as about 33 to 34% methane. So they go wide range for operating. I can't give you much more on the maintenance costs with those turbines because it's handled by RMT.
I would add that the lower the methane percentage that goes through those and the combustion, the more maintenance costs they're going to have, and probably the lower the longevity.
Okay.
I see.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jack and Mike, for your presentation. I'm really glad to hear all the enthusiasm from the participants in your great questions. I know we have a number of more questions that have come in online, but at this point I think I'd like to move on to our third presentation so that Terry has time to share with you his information, and then after his presentation we'll have another question and answer period. So anyone who has taken us off mute, please put us back on mute for Terry's presentation. So our next presenter is Terry Garron, and he's the president of Garron & Garron Incorporated and currently represents the solid waste interests of the Balcoma family in Indiana and Michigan, including the Southside Landfill and the Crossroads Greenhouse. Terry also represents the Michigan Waste Industries Association on legislative issues for the Michigan Senate and House committees, as well as on specific environmental issues before the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. He presently serves on Michigan DEQ's Planning and Solid Waste Advisory Committees and is the chairperson of the Indiana chapter of the National Solid Waste Management Association. Terry earned a BA degree in zoology from Hanover College and an MA degree in biology and microbiology from Drake University and completed 4 years of postgraduate studies in molecular genetics and bacteriology at Iowa State University. He was a research associate at Northern Michigan University and taught at the university level for 11 years, focusing on biology, molecular genetics, and bacteriology. He and his wife, Sandy, have 3 children, 10 grandchildren, and 2 great-grandchildren. And Terry, we're very excited to hear your presentation. And everyone, we're on slide number 42.
Thank you, Michelle. I would also mention that Kurt Pablo, who is the environmental compliance manager for Southside Landfill and the other family facilities, is also with me. He'll be available to answer questions. I would also note that Kurt was here from the beginning of the evaluation and implementation of the gas recovery program here at Southside. Our presentation is meant to demonstrate the methodical implementation of a gas recovery system at a former NPL site. We can go to slide 42. Southside Landfill is a privately owned landfill located in Indianapolis, Indiana. It opened in 1971. Southside Landfill was nominated for the National Priorities List, NPL, in 1986. The owners of the landfill signed an agreed order with the state that same year. As part of that agreed order, Southside Landfill constructed a soil bentonite slurry wall in 1987 and 1988. I would point out that slurry wall, as the landfill expands, is continually being built and will surround our entire facility. The NPL listing process continued to move forward despite the ongoing remediation work, and the site was listed in 1989. Southside Landfill was deleted from the NPL in 1997 following a no further action determination that found the earlier agreed order to be protective of health and the environment. Slide 43. Southside Landfill has a long history in the energy recovery business. Southside Landfill is a family-owned business. The corporate office is located in Kalamazoo, Michigan. The family owns several solid waste-related facilities in Indiana and Michigan. When the current owners purchased the facility in the mid-80s, they looked at landfill gas from a new perspective. Many people only thought of landfill gas as a liability or a nuisance. Some people still think that way, but the owners of Southside Landfill saw this gas as an energy resource and an asset that should be developed. That's why we started drilling wells here in 1985, so that we could begin to get a handle on exactly what we had and try to quantify it in some way, and I think you'll see as we go through this process some similarities with some of the things that Jack mentioned. slide 44. The first permanent extraction station consisted of two 30-horsepower Hoffman blowers operating in parallel. In this slide, you can see the separate inland pipes and the common discharge pipe. This is also a nice picture of the owners watching the first start of the flare. Slide 45. Flaring the gas enabled us to start measuring our production and begin to estimate how much gas might be available. That's one of the big problems with landfill gas recovery, figuring out how much a specific landfill can produce.
I'm listening.
Models are somewhat generic, and gas generation rates are heavily dependent on the composition of the waste. Slide 46. The first commercial use of the gas at Southside was the installation of the Cleaver Brooks 350-horsepower multi-fuel boilers. They are designed to burn landfill gas primarily, but they can manually be switched over to number two fuel oil if the landfill gas is unavailable. These boilers can consume up to about 500 cubic feet per minute each. Crossroads Greenhouse is built with landfill gas in mind. It's owned by the same family that owns the landfill, and I would point out this is a commercial greenhouse, and it has approximately 7 acres of land. Slide 47.
Terry, just let me interrupt for a second. We're getting a lot of feedback from somebody having a conversation, so I'd just like to remind everyone to put us on mute so they don't interrupt the presentation if you need to have another conversation with someone. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. Slide number 47. At roughly the same time, internal combustion engine generators were installed at Southside Landfill and Crossroads Greenhouse. These were used to generate electricity for on-site use, but even with these generators, the majority of the gas was simply being flared. Slide 48. Over the years, Southside Landfill tried to identify additional potential users for that excess gas. But back in those days, the typical response was, you want to put what in my boiler? Then in the late 90s, Granger Energy entered the picture. Granger is located in Lansing, Michigan, and was a pioneer in renewable energy, developing the first landfill gas recovery facility in Michigan in 1985. And as Jack was pointing out, I would also point out that Granger has facilities in several states that they have developed. And I know at least in the facility in Lansing, they have a contract with the local utility. Granger was able to negotiate a sales agreement with Rolls-Royce, an aircraft engine manufacturer located just north of the landfill. Rolls-Royce is located approximately a mile from our facility. Granger and Southside Landfill worked together to build this compressor station, which was started up in August 1999. Slide 49, please. The expansion of the project to Rolls-Royce required a pipeline, 7,200 feet of 12-inch HDPE, in order to get from the compressor station at the landfill to the boilers. The first boiler be converted was a 60,000 pound per hour coal boiler. It was converted to be able to coal fire on landfill gas and or natural gas. Once that boiler was proven, two other boilers followed within the next year. Slide 50, please. Rolls-Royce received statewide and national recognition for their participation in this project. They were awarded the Indiana Governor's Award for Excellence in Pollution Prevention in 2000. And the Industry Ally of the Year Award in 2001 from the EPA Landfill Methane Outreach Program. Slide 51. This chart shows the landfill gas production and delivery over that period of time. The gold is the gas produced, and the blue is the gas delivered or sold. In this chart, you can see that although Rolls-Royce has a huge appetite for energy year-round, there are still seasonal peaks and valleys. Granger and Southside Landfill wanted to come up with a way to flatten that line out, so that brings us to the next phase of the project. Slide 52. First solution to the seasonal consumption was still within Rolls-Royce. Granger, Southside, and Rolls-Royce worked together to bring landfill gas to an existing 5-megawatt Rolls-Royce gas turbine generator that was at another part of the Rolls-Royce facility. This is a cogeneration turbine, which means that the exhaust gases from the turbine are routed through a boiler using that waste heat steam. Slide 53. This expansion required building an additional 3,400 foot of 12-inch HDPE pipeline, a boost compressor that takes the gas up to about 300 pounds per square inch, and some special filtration to clean up the gas before it goes to the turbine. I might point out that all in all, we are supplying about 60% of the energy needs to the Rolls-Royce engine plant and about 15 to 20% of their electrical needs. Slide 54. Even with the turbine, there are still seasonal valleys in the gas delivered curve. So in 2009, Granger negotiated a sales agreement with a chemical plant adjacent to Rolls-Royce, Tellus Specialties Incorporated, provide them with some of this excess gas for use as boiler fuel. That part of the project is still in the startup phase. Slide 55. Southside Landfill has also served as a test site for high power energy systems of Anderson to develop a commercially viable medium BTU internal combustion engine generator. Slide 56. Here are a few statistics related to the gas production and delivery at Southside Landfill in 2009. You'll see that we captured and sold about 31 million pounds of methane. That equates to about 270 rail cars of coal, more than 4.4 million gallons of oil, or 291,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. And we would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Great. Thanks, Terry. At this point, I guess I'll open the phone lines first to see if anyone has any questions for Terry.
Hi, Michelle. Tom Bloom again.
Hi, Tom.
Talk about non-tangibles here. There's a golf course that's owned by the facility that anybody in the residential area can use for free. They graze longhorn cattle on it, which really makes it look neat. There's an industrial park that they rent out for industrial users that help out with the economy in the area. And that 6-acre greenhouse is very, very impressive. I was out there a couple of months ago checking that out. So there's a lot of, you know, things that go along with these projects that you can't really define. Oh, and I forgot to mention, during Earth Day, because I was out there right before Earth Day, they're running schools through there and doing educational outreach, I don't know, 20 a week or something like that. And in the summertime, they're bringing teachers through to teach them about what's going on in the landfill so that they can use the curriculum in the fall for their students. So once again, hats off to these people for really helping out the community and the surrounding area.
So thanks for your comments, Tom. I might add, if I may, that the members of that golf course is free. And that golf course is called Buffer Park, primarily because it's used as a buffer between the facility and the surrounding neighborhood. Rather than just leaving it a green area, the owners decided to build that golf course. I'd also point out that the owners have for years given free landfill space to the city of Indianapolis on all of their cleanup programs. And that's run very closely in conjunction with Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, which is a chapter of Keep America Beautiful. And I don't know exactly how many people run through here a year. You mentioned the students, but it's several thousand students a year that come through this facility. But I thank you for your comments, Tom. 6,000, I've been told.
You're welcome.
Are there any other questions from folks on the phone line? Okay. I guess we can get back to the online questions. Some of them came in while Jack was talking, but I think that, you know, perhaps any of our presenters might be qualified to answer them. So I'm going to throw the questions out there, and then Jack, Terry, Kurt, Mike, and Steve can jump in if you have a response or a comment to make based on that question. The first question I'm going to ask is there any technology to recapture the CO2 that is separated from the methane in the purification process?
This is Jack Dowden. Yeah, we've been, one of our partners is Lynn Gas Products. We've just started a plant out in the Bay Area of California to produce liquefied natural gas. And one of the waste products of that is CO2. And they are, now that they've got the LNG component of that process working, they are looking at focusing on the CO2 and looking at potential uses for that. You know, again, it's industrial grade. It would never be food grade. But there's, you know, I know that they're looking at potential reinjection into oil reservoirs for secondary recovery. Beyond that, I don't know exactly what applications and uses that, they've identified for it.
Okay. Jack, I think this question is more directed towards you because it came in during your presentation. What does PURPA stand for? PURPA?
PURPA, the Public Utility Power oh, I should know this one, and I don't. I failed this part of the quiz. It's a part of the Department of Energy regulations, something regarding regulation of public utility.
Okay.
I apologize. I should know that by heart.
I'm sure that the questioner can Google it.
Right.
Right. Okay. Let's see what question I should ask next. Regarding heat recovery, are there funding sources available to evaluate this? Anyone know the answer to that?
This is Jack Dowden again. Steve might know of some, maybe the people in Elmont do. We've never encountered anything.
Okay.
But say, Jack, you know, the school district knows on how much they've saved on heat prior to and now when they're using heat from the cogeneration system. So there's a cost on savings there.
Oh, sure. Sure. And let me be fair to that project. Tom is right. I mean, they're not going to fall way short of the $800,000 saving. And they are able to track both their heat and their electrical uses. Their savings.
Okay. Recovering gas from landfills is a finite effort. When does one know when to stop production?
When you turn off a gas control system is entirely dependent upon the environmental conditions. I've got a landfill in Wisconsin that we have been operating the gas system for 24 years. We are down to the 130 FCFM range. The gas is in the high 30s percentage. And because of the migration potential into the surrounding areas, we're going to be pulling on that for many years more. In areas, how long you pull you maintain the gas collection is entirely driven by environmental protection or environmental control parameters. How long you use it productively is a function of really just how much heat value you can get out of it. At some point in time, you're just not going to get enough heat value out of it to make it worth it.
Okay. The next question we have is, can EPA help pay for methane systems? We'll open that up to Steve.
Well, the short answer is EPA cannot use our own resources needed to clean up sites to help install a methane system. But if you have questions about the system in relation to the remedy or the safety for people who might be on site, EPA may be able to help you address those concerns. This is one of the questions that we are looking into to find out if there's any incentive from the federal sector, from, say, Department of Energy and Commerce Department for block grants to help the municipalities install the system. That's one of the things that we hope that we have. At least I know that LMOP has a list of potential sources for financing the system. We're trying to make sure that it can apply to Superfund sites.
Okay. Yeah, Steve. This is S.J. Chen, okay, Region 9 again. Yeah, I have actually one similar question try to ask you. Maybe, you know, you can provide an answer. You know, for example, you know, I have a big landfill site, probably one of, you have been in my site before, right?
Yes.
Okay. And the problem is, you know, while we are actually finished a lot of remedy stage, we put a lot of things at O&M stage. Now we are thinking about reuse a lot of energy or to either move into the green remediation process, evaluate the whole site, the resources available. The question is here, because this is a PRPD site, and you know, you want to do something, they got vendors come here, for example, put a solar, you know, that's a farm, you know, solar panel farm for that. And EPA has to get involved, review some of the documentation because, you know, those things maybe will jeopardize our remedy. The real issue is here, who is going to pay the cost? Or can EPA come out with a policy, you know, to say, yeah, if this is for the green technology, something part of the EPA's time we spend on those oversight, it can be waived or some other things. I think the probably EPA need to have a global, the policy, how we want to deal with that. And just like you said, the Department of Energy throw a lot of energy rebate, incentive, you know, and I really don't know, you know, what can we do?
Thank you for asking the question. Actually, we have internal discussions in the Superfund office.
Uh-huh.
One of the first piece of guidance that we're thinking about is on renewables REC. And so please stay tuned. We don't have anything to answer your question right now, but we are thinking about it.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Thanks, Steve. Is there any other questions from the phone? Okay, we have a couple more questions that came in online that I will continue asking. One of them is directed towards you, Jack. It said that you mentioned that leachate and condensate management in the gas extraction wells is a must. What means do you recommend to monitor the fluid in the wells? At what point is fluid in the wells a problem? And what measures do you recommend be implemented to remedy wells with excess fluid in them?
Well, again, you can... most gas well designs will allow for direct measurement of water levels in gas wells. And we found that in many of our most successful gas production wells, we put in pumps, mainly pneumatic pumps, to remove the liquids, you know, whether it's condensate or leachate. One of the characteristics of landfill condensate is it's acidic. pH is, you know, anywhere between 4 and 5. And, you know, we're still learning a lot about the interaction of condensate with our methanogenic bacteria that drive the whole methane generation process. But the thought is that under those pH conditions, you know, we're killing off some of the bacteria. So it's really essential to, particularly for the longevity of your gas wells, is to be able to remove that liquid.
Okay. The questioner has sent us what PURPA stands for, Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act.
There you go.
And then there's another question directed at you, Jack, regarding geo-loops in landfills and heat recovery. Is this realistic from an economic standpoint?
We've been penciling it out. We've been playing around with it. I think it is. Certainly it's relative. I mean, you see people putting geo-loops in, particularly for large-scale buildings, hydronic heating, and they're just drilling wells into the ground where temperatures, ambient temperatures are, 52 to 58 degrees. And yet some of the core temperatures of our landfills are in the 80s, 90s. So, if it's economic to do, with ambient ground temperatures, those economics would even be better within landfills.
Okay. We have one last question. What about sewage sludge? Are there current efforts to extract methane from this resource? This is Michelle. I actually can answer this. At least I know one facility, a POTW called East Bay Mud in California, that is doing that, and they're actually adding food scraps to their digesters to make them run more efficient and collect more methane. Do any of the speakers from today's call know of any other efforts to do that?
Well, we in the Midwest, we have a lot of the large-scale farming, either dairy or beef cattle or hogs, where they're collecting their manure. In some of these communities, I've heard in Wisconsin that they are taking some of the partially digested sludge out of the local treatment works, and they're combining that. It reduces their costs for aeration and treatment, reduces some of their land application costs. So they're kind of commingling, domestic sewage sludge with large animal sludge. And, I think there's a lot of potential both in confined animal facilities and in domestic sludge for future methane recovery.
Yeah, I actually visited some farms when I was in Wisconsin for a meeting, and they were doing exactly what you said, like adding other sources of organic materials to their manure digesters, and some of them were using some, waste from food industries that were nearby, too.
Mm-hmm. This is Perry. I know in Indiana there are some confined feeding scale operations that are going on. I'm not aware of the use of sludge, however.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, great. That's all the questions I had online. I guess we have maybe another minute or two if anyone on the phone has one last dying question they need to ask. Please speak up. Okay. I want to thank everyone for their presentations today. This is very informative, and I think we had a great lively discussion. So thank you to the participants, too, for your participation. And I want to just direct everyone to the last slide, slide 58, where you can click on links to additional resources associated to this topic, including success stories about sites that provide methane to local communities. And we also have a link to our feedback form, which we would love for you to fill out and let us know, your ideas for future seminars, because we're always looking for new topics. And like I mentioned at the beginning, SRI is doing these seminars monthly. So if you have any ideas of something you want us to pull together, we can certainly try to do that. But we don't know if you don't tell us. So, again, thank you to all the presenters. I really enjoyed today's session. And I look forward to future discussions on this topic.
Thank you.